Hello, welcome to another fine episode of the Tombstone Podcast, a podcast where we talk about video games, the video game industry, and whatever we want to talk about. My name is Devin.
I'm Kevin.
And I'm Zach.
And we are going to go round robin. What the hell have y'all been playing while quarantined? Let's go.
Well, I actually, I got to try something out. I got to play the Final Fantasy VII remake demo, which was actually, I was a little surprised. It was pretty good. I enjoyed it. I kind of want to go back and play original seven and then compare the two. And I feel like I've got a lot of extra time given the circumstances. So I'm going to probably go do that. And the actual full game comes out like early next month. So then I'll just hop right on that and see how that is.
Didn't they change up how the combat is?
Oh, totally.
How the combat works in that game?
Totally.
Like, but you can also do, like, can't you also change to the classic style of turn-based combat, but you can also do the new modern combat?
Really?
I didn't see anything in the demo that said that, at least.
So how it works is...
I thought I saw that mentioned or something.
Mm. Yeah, there's the normal, like, real-time combat, and then once... I think it's your limit break. Once it maxes out, you can do it, and it, like, pauses time, and then you sort of have your turn-based actions, but for a short period of time, and then it goes back to normal. So it's like a special thing you can do in combat, and that's where you get your big, powerful moves.
Yeah, so generally how it works, from my little bit of time, basically, you can press square, and you'll just hit, and basic hits. And then you build up like your active time meter, and you can open up a menu at that point and do any of your special moves. It's like this really weird hybrid, like it's real time, but like also you're building up a meter, but it's very strange. It works relatively well. And I thought it worked its best when you had like a party, because you would be one dude, you'd be like Cloud, and you'd hit, use a special move, you'd swap over to Barrett. Barrett's got his meter built up, and it's like, all right, have him do his special move. Flip over to Tifa. Tifa's like, hit. All right, now you can do a couple special moves. And it's like, it's fun to jump between all the people. I think that's when it works its best. But when I was just Cloud, I was like, this is fucking strange as shit. So
is it like fully voice acted as well? Or
oh, yeah, fully voice acted. Ton of cinematics.
Because I only ever played, I got halfway, because I got to Disc 2. I got a little bit into Disc 2, but I still never finished the original 7, so now I think I'm going to just wait to, what platforms is this going to be on?
PS4.
Fuck! Alright, never mind. Change of plans.
I'm pretty sure it's exclusive.
Play the original again.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's exclusive.
Yeah, shit, dude. That sucks.
Yeah, I was like, ooh, I might get it on PC because I just have a regular PS4 and I don't have a Pro and I'm not fucking getting a Pro. And then I was like, well, I guess I'm settling.
Hell yeah, dude. Hell yeah. Zach, what you got for us?
I'm just over here waiting for Animal Crossing at this point. We got a few more days to go. In the meantime, I'll probably pick up the Final Fantasy demo and try it out, but... Just
are you gonna also get Doom Eternal? Is that at all on your radar, or is it just Animal Crossing?
I never got into Doom. I may pick it up eventually, but not anytime soon.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, I'm excited for both of those.
Yeah, I feel like our whole group of friends is opting for Animal Crossing and then maybe eventually Doom.
I think I'm gonna pick both of them up and like binge, eat, like just keep binging both of them and just get, you know, play one for a few hours, get bored of it, go with the other one. So that way I can refresh, get back to the first one and just keep that cycle going. I really don't know anything about Animal Crossing or Doom Eternal for that matter, but I'm gonna play the shit out of them because I'm just watching gameplay of Doom 2016. It just looks so badass and fun, and I'm really excited for whatever else they have in store, because and then Animal Crossing is just going to be a nice chill. It'll be a reason for me to pick up my Switch again and just lay in bed and play games for a while. So that'll be nice. But as far as what I've been doing, I just got back into Stardew Valley. I've been playing for the past few days. It's a really fun game, really relaxing. Lots of back and forth walking, but that's fine because I'm still learning everything. Because I played for a while on my phone, but just stopped playing on my phone because it just get tedious to play. The controls are weird. Games on the phone are usually not that good. So yeah. It just got tedious to play and whatnot. And then also, Call of Duty Warzone, World at War, not World at War, Modern Warfare Warzone just got released. It's Infinity Ward's free to play battle royale. I mean, it's another battle royale. It's pretty fun. It's interesting. It's like 150 players, teams of three.
Oh.
You get down.
I thought you were meaning like total.
Oh no. It's all teams of three, 50 teams total.
Okay.
And whenever you get killed, like you go to the gulag and you get to fight for your life, fight for basically like a second chance, a free second chance, basically.
That's kind of interesting.
It's pretty interesting. And then you also gain money throughout playing, like opening chests and all that stuff in game, not in like the menu, not like pay to win chests, but actual in game loot chests.
Mm-hmm.
And you get money and you could buy upgrades and you can also buy your teammates back alive. It's pretty cool. It's interesting. I still think I like Apex as a battle royale, but I went ahead and bought the full version of Modern Warfare and I beat the campaign on the realism mode. That was fucking difficult, but that was also really satisfying. And I'm also been just playing the multiplayer. I want to do the co-op missions, but right now I think it's just me and Chance. I don't know if John Mark got. Yeah, I don't know who all has the full game yet, but I want to do the co-op missions and continue the story, basically.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah. So today we are going to be talking about Majora's Mask. This is Kevin's top Zelda game. So Kevin, if you want to take this away.
Yes. So it's not my number one, but Dominic so graciously stole my number one. So this is my number two. But I do hold that it has the strongest narrative of any Zelda game by a very big margin, because it's just super interesting in its theming. But to get started off, like, all right, so, you know, Zelda comes out, people like it. Zelda 2 comes out, no one likes it. Zelda Link to the Past comes out, hey, awesome. And then Link's Awakening comes out and barely anybody even notices for some reason. And then Ocarina of Time changes the shape of the gaming landscape for fucking ever. And then they were like, cool, that was really successful. We want another one of those, but we want another one of those, like, right the fuck now. So they were like, hey, I know y'all just finished Ocarina of Time, but like, make us another game and you have 18 months to do it. So that's where Majora's Mask comes from. They literally just came to them and said, all right, cool, we want another whole game as soon as you fucking can. And so in 18 months they make another game. But instead of just making essentially the same game again, or like some, you know, slightly different but mostly the same sort of sequel, they actually threw a lot of shit right out the window immediately and just made a totally different fucking game. Now, one of the quickest, like, most immediate sort of trade-offs that they had to make was there are a lot of reused assets. All of the character models are like exactly the same, except for Link. Link got a little bit of a polish. His movement also got a little bit of a polish and all of that sort of thing. But, you know, they reused a lot of stuff. And the next thing you'll notice is that the game is really, really goddamn short. as far as, you know, how many dungeons there are. There are 4 in the entire game. And this is like the first major switch in focus of the game, because there are only 4 dungeons, but there's a lot more shit to do outside of the dungeons. That has actually like pretty significant consequence, right? So the way it narratively it works is you're Link, if this is just after the events of Ocarina of Time, and you're in the woods looking for someone, presumably Navi, and eventually you get your shit hijacked, and the Skull Kid with the Majora's Mask takes your horse and your ocarina and fucks off, and he turns you into a Deku, which is like the first immediate difference is you have many forms in this game. You can be Link, you can be Deku Link, you can be Zora Link, and you can be Goron Link, and there are a bunch of million bajillion other masks that don't change your form but have unique effects. So it's basically like your inventory space like doubles, but we'll kind of get into the subtleties of the masks. But you get turned into a Deku scrub, you fucking stumble your way into a brand new fucking world called Termina, and the world is at risk of the moon crashing down into it, and the whole thing is that you've got 3 days to stop the moon from hitting Termina. So what you do is you kind of do all these like quests, and you're kind of locked in this city for a little bit, and you run around, do these quests, and figure out some people's schedules, and figure out, okay, this person goes here and this person goes here, this is the time that this dude goes here, and blah 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 blah. And it's like just enough that you can keep it all in your head, and in the process you actually get a notebook, like a proper quest log notebook, that says like, hey, this person has a special event at this time, and this person has a special event at this time. And, you know, you can like look through and go, oh, well, I haven't seen whatever this special event is, so let me be there at this time. And it's just this like coordination of discovering like who's doing what at what times, figuring out their schedules, figuring out their problems, trying to solve their problems. And it, like, that's one of the biggest, hugest differences between Ocarina of Time and this game, is that in Ocarina of Time, it had the day-night cycle, but really all that meant was if it's day, they're doing this. If it's night, they're doing this. And generally, quests stay still for an indeterminate amount of time until you go in and do a thing, and then that changes their situation. In Majora's Mask, you're on a 3-day timer, and as the 3 days go by, people start doing different things and being in different places and doing different things. And doing things during their special events will make different things happen later. So you can also manipulate that person's path, essentially. It's like, if you help them here, they'll do something else later, and then you'll get something from that. Or you help this person now, and that makes this other person able to be helped, and so on and so forth. So it's this really neat, like, focus on all the other characters. And it's really interesting because, like how I said, you can change your forms. You can turn into Deku, Goron, and Azora. A lot of your actions don't get attributed to you. Like, no one really knows who you are, and no one really says, hey, Link, thanks, and like continues to acknowledge you for it. A lot of times you'll just fix something and that'll be it. You know, they don't know that you did it, or they attribute it to someone else. You're basically like almost like a social ghost, and no one's really noticing what you're doing, but it's affecting everyone else at all times. You know, doing one thing affects another person, and so on. And so I just, I really enjoy that new focus, because it's not about Link anymore. It's not Link's like typical hero's journey. It's the story of the people of Termina, and Link is just the lens through which you view that narrative. And a lot of people have a lot of different motives, a lot of different things they're trying to do, a lot of different problems. And doing all of that is the bulk of the game, and it's by far the most interesting component of the game. Because like I said before, there are only four dungeons, and the dungeons are kind of not that great, really. They're really short, and I do like that they're kind of open and freeform. It's just kind of like you can get almost everywhere immediately, but it's like you can't get through here until you do this, until you do this, until you do this. So it's kind of freeform, but they're really small and they're not that interesting. So I'd say like this is one of the weirdest Zeldas, because the part that's probably the weakest is the part that most people would look at and go, oh, that's a Zelda game. You know, all the dungeons and like the main quest is kind of like, all right, sure, but discovering all these other people's narratives and fucking with the timeline, and you know, you when you get to the end of the 3 days, you can go back to the beginning of the 3 days and just repeat until you know, get everything done and you can finally stop the moon from hitting Termina.
What I've never understood about the game, so you can go back to day one. What progress is actually kept whenever you go back to day one?
Yeah, so what is kept is key items that Link gathers, pretty much. So it's like you'll get, I don't know, let's say the bow. And the bow gets you access to the mountains. So, you know, you go through a 3-day arc where you do the dungeon in the Southern Swamp, and you get the bow and you get the like Demon's Remains or whatever, which is like the key item to progress. You get that stuff, but when you go back in time, everything is eliminated. So like that dungeon is unsolved now, and that boss is around again, and all of the people's like problems that you solved are completely undone. But you have any key item that you got from it. So if you got an item or a mask or anything like that from doing it, you still have that. And that's, to me, that's kind of, that makes it more of that like interesting, like your tasks as Link go unnoticed, because like even if you do a bunch of shit, and even if they say, hey, thanks, Link, when you reset time, that is all undone. It's like completely undone. Yeah. But you have the items to get wherever you need to go.
Okay. That makes sense.
It's almost like a roguelite in a way, where it's like, oh, you died, but you can now get to new places.
Yeah, so Link's progress is permanent, but the progress in the world, like he can, the time travel is like he can take shit with him back, but everything else goes back to how it was. So that's where like you have the key items. Mm-hmm. So he has all the key items, but everything goes back to where it was.
Oh,
that's interesting.
Yeah, and like for an easy example, in this game you can gather stray fairies, which are like fragments of a great fairy. You can gather them and bring them back to the Great Fairy Fountain, and it'll assemble into a great fairy, and she'll give you some sort of power-up. And it's like, all right, cool. You get that power-up, you have that increased ability, you go back in time, that great fairy is no longer there, split into all the stray fairies again. So it's like, you keep what you get, but, you know, everyone forgets it. So like everything you do basically didn't happen. And like even in the end of the game, it like it kind of hops back a bit to where basically you didn't do anything. No one ever notices what you did. Like by the time you're done, it's like nothing happened at all, you know? So it's like, again, like Link's this sort of weird passerby in this world, and he's just like, I'm not a part of this world, but I'm gonna fix it and then fuck off, and no one's even gonna know, you know. So
yeah, because this is Termina, which is a different
mm-hmm.
is it different than Hyrule?
Totally different
than, right?
It's not clear how yeah. different the it most people and most things would suggest that it's a parallel dimension, because it has people who look exactly the same as they did in Ocarina of Time, but they aren't actually the same person, and they have no recollection of Link or anything from Ocarina of Time. So it's like, it's a parallel dimension with like a lot of the same people, but you know, they're different people. They just look exactly the same and generally behave similarly.
So whenever you go through, so you have to do like a, like XYZ to get through this door.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have to, and say you go back in time and you have to come back to this door, do you have to do XYZ again? Or is there a lot of times are there like, oh no, there wouldn't necessarily be any shortcuts that you could take, because you'd have to get an item to give you shortcuts,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah, but that's usually how they handle it, is it's not like a geographical shortcut. It's like almost like a Metroid shortcut. Well, that would even be geographical. It's just like imagine like you do all X, Y, and Z and you get a key and you keep that key and now you can get through that door. Well, when you skip back time, X, Y, and Z still didn't happen, but you still have the key and you can get through the door. You know, it's usually how it works.
Okay.
You
yeah.
usually get something
yeah.
that allows you to get further without having to do X, Y, and Z again.
Yeah, because I was about to say it'd be fucking annoying to just every time I want to go through this stupid door that I have to go through all the time, I got to do X, Y, Z to get
yeah,
through it.
Yeah, no, it's very much item-based shortcuts, essentially. There are some longer quests that I would say border on that sort of issue, but you don't have to do it all the time. It's just like there's a particularly long quest, the Anju and Cafe quest. Those are two characters, and it's like a love story between them, but Cafe was cursed into looking like a child, and then he can't face his bride-to-be, Anju, and, like, it's, like, this crazy long. It takes, like, the whole 3 days just to do this quest. And if you fuck up, it's, like, well, you gotta start again. You know, so that's like, the worst of it. But even then, that's not that hard, because you can skip forward in time fairly easily to the points where the events happen. So even then,
okay.
Yeah, so it's, like, whoops, I fucked up the quest, and I gotta restart the day. It's, like, yeah, that's annoying, but it's not an enormous penalty, and that's the only time it's really that bad. Most quests are like two or three events long, and it's kind of hard to fuck it up. So like I said, it's interesting in how it's so people focused. It's all about, you know, finding, you know, this person, like, oh, okay, they go here, oh, these two characters interact, let me stop that interaction. You know, there. One particular example is there's the bomb shop. The bomb shop's owner has an old grandma she's like delivering something. She's delivering some of her bombs. And there's a thief who comes and steals the bombs. And it also has a bomb bag in it. So if he steals it, then there's the curiosity shop, which sells stolen goods. So if the thief steals that, it's in the curiosity shop. But if you stop that theft from happening, the bomb bag is in the bomb shop the next day. And if you do that, then the curiosity shop doesn't have the bomb bag, and instead it has the all-night mask. So it's like, okay, well, like, one way this thing happens, and another way this other thing happens. And it's interesting weaving all the people's schedules together, because sometimes you'll prevent something like that, and then you won't see them in one location, you'll see them in another location doing something else. So that's where most of the like kind of puzzle solving happens, is okay, where is this person, what are they doing, what do I need to do to change the course of their actions? And that's like totally up to like that 3-day cycle thing. You can just do it over and over and see the different results.
Yeah. So back to like what you said about this being like very people focused, because like this is definitely a more emotional Zelda mm-hmm. game than we've ever had, and yeah, basically ever had, like before then and since then. This is the most emotional, and lots of heavy dark themes that come through this game that we don't see that happen. Like Breath of the Wild, even though it is very like bleak, abysmal, and like post-apocalyptic, it's still very cheery.
Yes.
Like the people are very cheery and happy most of the time, and it just doesn't reflect the kind of world that they live in. And then with Majora's Mask, you have these people that live in this world where the moon is just gonna fucking crash on them, and there's nothing that they can do, and they know that they're just gonna die. So it's like hey, you know, the Russians just launched nuclear weapons our way, so let's all just hold hands and be here with each yeah. other. Like, it's that kind of level of like, what do we do? And because I know that's something that as the days go on, people get more and more terrified. Like the first day, it's like, oh hey, blah blah la ti da, and then like the second and third day, especially like the third day, getting really close to when the moon's about to land, it's just pure chaos between mm-hmm. and everybody, and everyone's just terrified, and it's just really dark, because yeah. there's also just like kids around that are just like, and their parents are like trying to comfort them and whatnot. Mm-hmm. It's pretty dark.
Yeah, and like that was that's the biggest thing about this game. Like I said, it's the by far strongest narrative of any Zelda game ever, and it's because of that sort of theming. And it did everything to set that atmosphere so strongly. Like, you'll see people, like you said, they'll, as the days go on, like first day, there's a hustle and bustle around the city. People are setting up for the carnival, which is going to happen pretty much the exact moment the moon hits. So they're like setting up, and they're like, all right, yeah, yeah, blah, blah, blah. And you can hear some people like, bah, the fucking moon hitting us, that's fucking bullshit, that's never gonna happen. And then some other people who are like, hey, did you hear about the moon? The moon's looking pretty big, you know. And like as the days go on, you start seeing people like leave, and they're evacuating, essentially they're running away, and you just still see some people who are like in denial. They're like, the moon's not gonna hit, you know. The banker who, like, you can give him your money and stuff to hold on to it between time jumps, you can walk up to him, and he's just like, oh yeah, don't worry about the moon. Anyway, like, what's going on? And it's like, the moon's literally barreling down on us. Like, I can see it. It's right the fuck there. There's an example of, like, there's like a swordsman who, he has his own little dojo, and if you ask him about the moon, he's like, the moon, whatever. If the moon crashes, I'll just slice it in half with my sword. Like, I am not afraid of the moon. And then come to the final night, right as the moon's about to hit in like a few minutes, you can't find him. And then, like, if you look hard enough, there's like this secret room in his dojo that he's just in there cowering in fear. And he's just like, please, I don't want to die. In this fucking, like, child's fucking Nintendo 64 game, people are like cowering in fear, and they're in denial, and like, it's fucking fucked. And like, a lot of people are dead in the narrative. Like, the way you get the masks, the three major form changing masks, Deku, Goron, and Zora, those all come from a deceased Deku, Goron, and Zora. You get the Deku one without even realizing it, but then you get the Goron one from a Goron ghost who, like, you help him pass. And then you get the Zora one from a Zora who, like, just dies right in front of you. And so then you're like, well, shit, these masks are coming from dead people. Who the fuck did the Deku mask come from? But then you think back to the beginning of the game, and there's this, like, horribly disfigured, like, tree with a face on it. And it's like, oh, the Skull Kid killed that Deku to make the mask that I now wear. And it's just like really fucked up. And then even in the, like the fucking post credits scene, there's this Deku that you meet, you know, later on, and you race him, and he's like, "Oh man, you remind me of my son," and blah 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 blah, because you're in the form of a Deku. And then like post credits, you see him like weeping openly in front of this like dead disfigured tree, and it's just like, what the fuck, Nintendo? Like, my God. It's fucking wild, like, all the stuff they put in there. And, like, that's all the stuff is, you're either helping people, like, cope with something, or, you know, you're trying to prevent bad things from happening to them, but bad things happen anyway. You can help people, and then they're like, cool, but now the moon's gonna crash into us, and we're all gonna die anyway. And even the Anju and Cafe quest, you can only solve it at the very end, like 1 minute before the world is about to explode. And so they have like 1 minute to be together and happy. And they're like, cool, I'm going to just reset this shit now because you have to. And it's just like, oh my God. Like the theming of like, of death and coping and denial and fear and all of that is just so strong in this game. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty fucking heavy. Just like these ads are pretty fucking heavy.
Goddamn them heavy ads.
Hello. Welcome back. We're going to keep talking about this, fucking fever dream of a game. So the, like we mentioned beforehand, like assets are basically the same and there's a little bit polish of it. So I don't like this game for the same reason why I didn't really like Ocarina of Time, in that it hasn't really aged well as far as gameplay goes.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. And, well, for one thing, generally, if you're not a fan of the old school, you know, the Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask controls, I recommend giving the HD remake on the 3DS a try, because it smooths it out wildly. But yes, as far as the original version, it's just this, like, it's still sloppy. There's a bit of polish there in his movement, but it's still pretty sloppy. Aiming is really sloppy, which really comes into focus.
You have to aim more in this one.
Well,
cause
isn't there a lot more?
Cause don't you have I thought you had like, what is it? As a Deku, don't you have like the bubble thing that you can do or something?
Yeah, but you really only have to use the bubble like a couple times. And a lot of those times you can lock on. So that's not a huge deal,
but
I will say that there are mini games that have heart pieces behind them and key items, well, maybe not key items, but like masks behind them and like quiver upgrades and stuff like that. And those are an enormous pain in the ass on the original version. And, you know, like I said, movement is still sloppy. I can still get frustrated with those sorts of things. And it kind of goes back to what I said at the beginning. The parts that I think are the worst about this game are the parts that just are Zelda parts. You know, it's like pretty much anything that got brought over from Ocarina of Time is a bad part of this game. And everything they added on to the game is like totally different and really fucking interesting, you know? So as far as like, you know, running around and fighting enemies and doing that sort of thing and like exploring a dungeon, it's like that's all kind of like the lesser part of the game. The best part of the game is like running around and figuring out people's schedules and like figuring out how to like best solve their quest and doing all this, you know. So yes, I would very much say that it's, if you don't like the way Ocarina of Time controls, you're not going to like the way this controls. I would recommend trying the 3DS remake at that point.
Which hopefully, can you emulate 3DS stuff?
Yeah, you can emulate that. Well, you can emulate it. I know that emulating 3DS might be like a little clumsy at times, but with this game, literally all the touchpad does is like menuing. So you can do that fairly easily. So if you wanted to emulate this game, yeah, I'd say it's pretty doable.
I can't look into that.
Yeah, I can't speak to the quality of that because I haven't done it. Like, I don't know, like, how, like, oh, if the joystick feels weird, that would be up to the emulator. I can't really speak to that, but theoretically, it should work.
Yeah, yeah. Understood. So what are some other main points that you want to hit on this game?
Yeah, so I was going to, while you had me on the topic of flaws, I was going to kind of dig into what I think are some flaws I find with the game. So first off, we've got four dungeons, which, depending on your perspective, might be a good or bad thing. I personally like that there's so few, because that's not the good part of the game. I would say the last two dungeons are fairly interesting, but the first two are not as much. That to me, that's the part of the run where I'm just kind of going through the motions. I'm like, all right, let's just get through this. And they also they do the stray fairy thing, which I brushed past earlier. And that's every dungeon has a great fairy associated with it. And in the dungeon, you have to find and collect 15 hidden stray fairies. Sometimes they're, you know, in a like behind an illusory wall or inside of a box, or you kill an enemy and it pops out, or it's in a treasure chest. And, you know, it's just they could be fucking anywhere. And you don't have to do that. But if you don't, then the dungeons feel incredibly short. It's just like, run here, get the dungeon map, run here, get the compass, run here, get the item, go fight, run here, get the big key, and then fight the final boss. And it's just like, done. You know, if you don't look for the stray fairies, it kind of shortens it by a very, very much. And doing the stray fairies is totally optional, but it gets you some really nice upgrades, like doubling your magic meter. And I know you get the super spin attack, which is really good. And then you get probably the best one is the Great Fairy Sword, which is just like a big fuck off two-handed weapon. And that is really nice to have. But I think that the Stray Fairies was just a way for them to go, well, we've only got so much dungeon. Let's kind of maybe make it last a little longer by giving you like this collectible you have to get. So I don't think the dungeons are particularly strong in the game, which is why it's kind of a strength that there's so few, because there's not that many. And again, I think a lot of this comes back to that incredibly aggressive 18-month turnaround time, where they were just like, all right, well, we know it took you 2.5 years to make Ocarina of Time. You have 1.5 to make a sequel to it. So, you know, I feel like a lot of that came from that problem right there. Another problem I would say this game has is the rewards for quests are very often not worth it. Basically, your most frequent thing you get from a quest is either a heart piece or a mask. And heart pieces are fine. You know, you can miss like a good chunk of them and it really won't affect you very much. Missing masks, you might think that it's like that it is kind of a big deal. It's like, oh, all these masks I'm missing out on. But like, really, a lot of masks are single use. They only have like one. It's like a point and click adventure game at times. You'll get a mask and it has one specific use at one specific point. And that's it. And you never use that mask again. A good example is the All Night Mask. That mask, all it does is it allows you to stay awake. That's it. And what it does is there's this old lady who tells you a story, and it functions as like a time skip normally, because she starts the story, you fall asleep, and then you wake up and she's like, oh, well, 6 hours have passed. You nodded off. But if you wear the all-night mask, you get to hear the whole story. And she's like, oh, thanks for listening to the story. And then she gives you a heart piece, and that's it. That's all you use that mask for, ever. And there's a lot of masks that are single use. I would say probably 75% of the masks are used one time and then never again. So the reward for doing quests is just kind of like the ability to do another quest, I guess, until like the eventual end of, hey, you know, here's a heart piece, essentially. You know, it's like, I did this quest to get this mask, to get this mask, to get this mask, and that got me this heart piece. You know, it's like, all right. You know, if you're not satisfied by the quest itself, the reward is not incredible. Now, fortunately, I find the quests to be pretty satisfying in and of themselves. But it's very much like this game is like a hybrid between a point-and-click adventure game and a Zelda game. Because, like, you'll get those single use, and you're like, I don't even know where the fuck to use this. You know, probably my favorite example is, you go through that Anju and Cafe quest, and all you get is the couple's mask, which is a mask, like, representing, like, a bonding of two people, and it just sits on your face and doesn't do anything. And you're just like, all right, where the fuck do I use this? And you go into the mayor's office, and they're all yelling about whether or not to call off the carnival because the moon's coming down and blah, blah, blah. And you just wear the mask, and they go, oh, there, a couple got married. Now we're not mad anymore. All right, here's a heart piece. You know, it's like,
what?
Yeah, like,
that's like, what the fuck?
Yeah, a lot of that shit.
What kind of moon logic is this?
Exactly. it's way like over the top. Like, I don't know where the fuck to use this. And like, I feel like your first run of the game, if you try to 100% it, the game, it's like, it's pretty long, just because you're like, okay, what does this do? What does this do? What does this do? Like, what can I do here to make them not yell at each other anymore, you know?
Because then you also have, like, okay, what does this do here on day one? Okay, what does this do here on day two? Okay, what does this do here on day three?
Yeah.
Like, there's so many different possibilities of what the fuck does this do, you know? So I can't imagine trying to riddle everything out in one playthrough. Like, that would be excruciating and miserable.
Yeah, and I will say that, you know, the flaw I mentioned with the every mask has only one use, like most masks only have one use, it's like, well, it kind of helps you, because if you have a mask and you're like, I haven't used it yet, you know, it's like, well, I probably use it somewhere. So eventually your possibility pool gets narrowed through like process of elimination. It's like, oh, I got the Keaton mask, oh, that does this. Okay, well, it probably doesn't do anything else, you know? So it's like, through process of elimination, you could eventually find out that the couple's mask does that, but it takes you a while to get there. And so, like, some of the logic is pretty convoluted, but it is interesting to figure out. I do find that I was satisfied trying to piece it all together. At least, I feel like getting all masks is pretty doable. Knowing the use for all those masks, not always super easy to figure out, but you can at least get all the masks with relative ease. But yeah, I would definitely say that the crazy point and click adventure game logic is it's a bit of a flaw. It kind of depends on your perspective, but I think it's, you know, less than intuitive.
Interesting. Yes. Yeah, because I hate. That's one thing that's like with some Zelda games is that sometimes the logic can be like going back right now, I'm at Ganon on Link to the Past, but some of the puzzles that you have to do to get through the game to get certain items and to get through dungeons and all that, it's a little bit convoluted, and I really know how to do it because I've beaten the game a few times, you know, when I was younger. So I've just retained that knowledge of, oh, this looks very familiar. I think I have to go this way and this way and do this thing. And just thinking back, being like, how the hell did I figure any of this stuff out when I was little? Because it's just moon logic for the most part. Unless you go and talk to literally every single person that you find, and one of them might give you a good hint that's like, hey, I saw this thing in this building that looked weird. And you're like, okay, wait, what thing in what building? Mm-hmm. And then you go and check it out, and you're like, this is what I was looking for.
Yeah. And yeah, an example I usually go to in Ocarina of Time is there's this fucking long-ass trading sequence that, like, I'm pretty sure everyone hates. Most people hate it. It's not essential for beating the game. It's completely optional, but, like, you'll get, you know, you get, like, this mushroom, and then, okay, the mushroom helps you find a special frog, and it's like, all right, cool. I don't know where the frog is, but all right. And then you get the frog or whatever, and it's like, all right, you bring it to this guy who has said nothing about frogs, by the way. You bring it to him, and he's like, oh, cool, I can make eye drops. And you're like, what? Eye drops? And then you, like, go to the top of Death Mountain, and there's a giant gore, and he's like, oh, my fucking eye drops. It's like, what the fuck? But, like, that sort of shit drives me nuts. At least what Majora's Mask has is that notebook, and I can't express how essential that notebook is. It's like the first quest log in the entire series. You know, you haven't seen it again until Breath of the Wild, but this is just like, it's a schedule, and it just has this little block, and it's like, something happens during this time for this person, and you know that you have to do something there. And usually it's pretty obvious, but sometimes it's like, I just know something has to happen here. And so you can just like, what about this mask? What about this mask? What about this item? What about this mask? Like, da 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 da. You know, sometimes they'll prompt and say, oh, I need something that revitalizes my strength. And you're like, I guess a potion, you know? But some of them are, you just kind of get it because you know you need to do something. So I feel like the it's called the Bomber's Notebook. And that notebook really, really fucking helps out the game a lot because it makes it super, super manageable from that point on. It's just kind of, oh, I know this person's here, and I know that something is fucking happening here, or I can do something here.
So, who's your favorite character in this game?
Ooh, favorite character in the entire game? Kind of parsing through them really quick.
I'd say the Happy Mask Salesman.
He's pretty cool. He's like fucking weird as shit.
He is weird as shit.
Well, he's like, he plays a more central role because he had the Majora's Mask and the Skull Kid stole it from him. And that's what kicks off everything. And at the beginning, he's like, oh, you've met a terrible fate, blah, blah, blah. And his animations like pop like from pose to pose, and no other character does it. So it's like, it's on purpose. So like, he'll be like leaning over, kind of gesturing with his hand. And then you hit A to go to the next dialogue, and he just pops into a totally different position, like zero frame transition. And he's fucking like weird and otherworldly. It's very strange. And so I like him a lot. I'd say he's probably among my favorite. Yeah, probably actually him, just because he's so fucking weird, and like suddenly he's like really important, whereas like before he didn't mean shit. I like that. Well, honestly, I think I like the Skull Kid the most, like the main antagonist, because his story is like super sympathetic, because he's a Skull Kid like you would see in the woods. Devin, you never played Ocarina of Time, but in that game they established that Kokiri that get lost in the woods become Skull Kids, and they're just kind of like a race of being. And this one Skull Kid, he's just kind of like, he's running around, and you know, he's alone, and he doesn't have friends, and he's scared, and he's cold, and these two fairies, Tattle and Tail, they befriend him, and they hang out, and they're the ones who steal your shit in the beginning. And eventually you buddy up with Tattle because she gets separated from the other two, and she's like, all right, well, we got to get back together. And then she's like, yeah, I know, we kind of fucked up, and honestly, he's been acting really strange recently. Well, like, it turns out that he was friends with the four giants, which you're awakening the four giants as part of your main quest, and they will grab the moon and throw it back up. So he was friends with those four giants, but the four giants had to like seal themselves away. So they're like, goodbye. And he's like, but I miss my friends. And like he, most of the shit he does is because he's scared and alone and maybe a bit jealous. And he thinks that his giant friends hate him. And they're like, no, we don't hate you. And like the, really it's the Majora's Mask like corrupts him to make him do those things. So I would say the Skull Kid's probably the single most interesting character in the game because he just kind of, he's the most sympathetic antagonist of any Zelda game. You know, normally it's just like, it's Ganon and I'm just evil because I want to rule the world, you know, and this time yeah, this time it's fucking Skull Kid and he's sad and alone and afraid and that's why he's doing what he's doing. And it just totally makes sense. And you end up beating the game. Like, you know, I don't think you're a bad guy. You just were misguided, you know?
I'm trying to think of other games that I've played like that recently where, you know, Zangief, you're a bad guy, but it does not mean you're a bad guy, right?
You're not the bad guy.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to think of like, because there's been a few that I've played like that where it's, you just really feel for the,
yeah,
the person that's the quote-unquote antagonist. I can't think of any of them right now.
Well, that's kind of the thing is it doesn't really very often happen in video games. Like, the villain doesn't get a whole lot of fleshing out because it's like the more time they spend fleshing out the antagonist is time that you're not being the protagonist, you know? So, you know, a lot of games will establish the protagonist, blah, 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 blah. And a lot of games will have like a twist with the protagonist, like, oh, we've established him to be this, and psych, he's actually this. But you don't often get a lot of attention played to the antagonists. And I would say, for me, probably the only other game I can think of off the top of my head that does something similar is Nier Automata. Because that game really like characterizes all of its, you know, it's hard to even call them antagonists because they get so characterized. So it's definitely a very, very rare occurrence in video games to have such a characterized antagonist that you feel for and you understand why they're doing what they're doing.
That's pretty dope.
It's pretty dope.
Yeah, like having sympathetic, any kind of sympathetic characters, just because it just feels lame a lot of times whenever you just have this BBEG, just this big bad evil guy that he's evil, he's made of sand, you know, and like that's it, that's mm-hmm. all, that's as far as his character really goes. And to have someone that's actually not two-dimensional but like actually is kind of human-like and that they have these certain motivations that you probably don't understand why they would have those motivations or why they would turn to this based off of those motivations. But you can kind of understand that, hey, maybe this person got some shit cards dealt to in their life and this is how they've kind of gone through and, you know, made the best of whatever situation that they get. Instead of it just being, hey, I'm literally, you know, evil incarnate and I'm here to rule the world. So if we could just wrap this up by 12:30, because I got some people to flay, you know, and like those kind of games are like they're always more focused on the action and like being in the game and being like EA Sports. But they're usually more meant to feel like a badass. And most Zelda games, you don't necessarily feel like a badass. Well,
I think
definitely Majora's Mask is that you don't feel like a badass.
Yeah.
Definitely like Breath of the Wild and there's some of them. There's some of them that can kind of gate the difficulty in a certain way to where like you always feel like, oh, you know, like I need to get this upgrade in order to do more damage to these people. So then the difficulty curve and how much damage you deal versus how much damage is dealt to you is kind of roughly the same throughout the game. It like dips and weaves because you get certain upgrades. But in, you know, Breath of the Wild, it's definitely like your power just fucking goes through the roof because you have cooking and all that that you can do. Yeah. And in Majora's Mask, it's really, again, it's not about you really. The game isn't necessarily about you. Like you said, you're kind of this person that accidentally stumbled upon this world and you're just going to help it and leave, and no one's really going to know that you were ever there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really interesting way of building stories.
Yeah. Like, kind of two things on that. One, I will say something I probably neglected to mention was there's very minimal combat in Majora's Mask. Like, combat is very, like, very minor part of this game, whereas Ocarina of Time very often would, you know, kind of, oh, the door closed behind you, now you have to face the thing, you have to fight the thing. There's very little forced encounters in Majora's Mask. Combat's not as much of a thing. Like, I would say the bosses are probably, like, the biggest moment of, oh, I gotta fight some shit. But there's only, like, a few of them. You know, there's five total in the whole game. So, it, like, combat's way, way less of a focus in this game. And the other thing I wanted to mention was that Breath of the Wild, I actually think, is a particularly bad example of characterizing Ganon, because he's literally conveyed to be this, like, force of nature. He's not even human anymore. He gave up his human form. He's just a ball of hate and anger, and he's just malice incarnate, and that's it. And it's like, all right, so he doesn't get characterized at all in that game. And granted, they spend more time characterizing the other, like, hero characters, but they definitely don't take
there's no evil person that they characterize at all in that whole game.
Yeah,
I mean,
because it's just Ganon and his minions, and none of them
and
ever talk.
Four different forms. Yeah.
So it's like, I would say Breath of the Wild is particularly weak in that characterizing category. It takes some time to characterize, you know, like, your heroes in a way that a lot of other Zelda games haven't. But as far as, like, characterizing, like, Ganon or giving, like, a reason, because even in Wind Waker, which I replayed recently, he has this, like, monologue near the end about how, like, he's like, you think the gods helped you? You think the gods saved you? It's like, motherfucker, the gods destroyed you, you know? Like, he has this whole, like, monologue at the end where he's like, no, I'm not the asshole. The gods are the assholes. And I'm gonna take back Hyrule and make it not shit anymore. Of course, it's not shit in his own perspective. But, you know, he has a motive. But then again, you only hear it at the very end of the game. And Majora's Mask, it's like, from the get-go, it's like, before you can even go to the first dungeon, you get this, like, backstory about the Skull Kid being alone and cold and then befriending the two fairies and them, you know, frolicking through the meadows and getting along and then slowly turning toward, like, hey, we're gonna steal shit to get by, and, all right, well, we're gonna take this mask, and oh, now we've got all this power because we've got this mask. Now we can really get shit done, you know? And it's like, before you even go to the first dungeon, you're getting all this shit about the Skull Kid. And it's like, ah, he's so much better than any other antagonist of any other Zelda game.
I agree. Is there anything, any other last minute things? Zach, you got any input?
No.
Nothing. All right. Well, is that everything?
Yeah, I think we're good.
Okay. Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Tombstone Podcast. You can find us anywhere that fucking pods are being casted. You can leave us a like and you can leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcast. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram and whatever else is out there. You can find us on TikTok. We're not TikTok.
Maybe we need to branch out.
Yeah, we're on Vine too right now. You can follow our Bebo account.
Our fucking hour-long podcast is broken down into 5-second videos.
Yeah, we broadcast explicitly on Snapchat.
Yep. It's not going to be there for very long. It's only going to be there for 24 hours.
Yeah. We'll save it for you guys so we can rebroadcast it eventually. All right. Anyways, thank you so much for listening to this, and we'll see you later.